It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Along the Gulf Coast and in other parts of the country, homeowners are finding that the very walls of their homes are toxic. An estimated 100,000 homes in more than 20 states were built with toxic drywall imported from China between 2004 and 2007. That drywall corrodes plumbing and electrical systems. Homeowners blame it for headaches and respiratory ailments. It's a big problem. It's growing, and it affects not just homeowners, but builders and the mortgage industry. From Miami, NPR's Greg Allen reports.
In Florida, Louisiana, North Carolina, and other states, thousands of homeowners have had an experience like Luis Gonzalez. Last year, when he and his wife, Carrie, moved into their new home in Homestead, Florida, he says they noticed an odor. They thought it was because it was a new house that had been closed up for a year before they moved in. But after living there for several months, Gonzalez says he became suspicious.
Well, the smell continued. As much as we cleaned and did stuff, it's still there in the house. And then I heard about this Chinese drywall. I started to check on the electrical outlets and the air conditioners, and that's when I noticed that everything was turning black and I was having an issue.
If you smell when you come up here, it's like a sulfuric, you know, like a weird smell when you get up here.
Kind of like a burnt match. That's sulfur smell. Like
that's that sulfur, yes.
Gonzalez takes me upstairs to a bathroom where he opens a cabinet.
And, for example, this is underneath the sink. If you look underneath, you see all the piping? It's black. Copper piping, black all the way through.
The problem began to emerge about a year ago. Tests found that Chinese drywall imported during the peak years of the building boom emits sulfide gases. The gases corrode copper coils in air conditioning systems and wiring in appliances and electrical outlets. Those are the known effects. Federal and state health officials are trying to determine what the health effects might be for people who live in houses with the toxic drywall.
Hey, buddy. Yeah.
Outside, Gonzalez picks up his 3-year-old son, Luis Andreas. Gonzalez is a burly man, an officer with the Miami Gardens Police Department. All 3 members of his family have been treated for health problems they worry may be related to the drywall. About 3 weeks ago, they moved out of their house and took an apartment. Now Gonzalez is wondering how to pay rent and at the same time a mortgage for a house they can't live in.
I called the bank and I asked for help. I asked them if they can please hold on for 6 months because I cannot afford to pay this mortgage and pay rent elsewhere. It's just not in my budget. As a police officer, I don't make that much money. So I was hoping they would help me, and they're not willing to help.
I make the analogy that it's like a small wave on the horizon. And this small wave, if not correct, is going to continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger until it hits the shores of Florida like the tsunami.
David Durkee is a lawyer who represents hundreds of homeowners in Florida with toxic drywall. Many, like Luis Gonzalez, just want the problem fixed. He's hoping his builder may respond to the threat of a lawsuit and replace all the defective drywall in his house, a job that typically costs $80,000 to $100,000. But it's not just builders and homeowners who stand to be hurt by the growing number of houses found to have Chinese drywall. The toxic homes also pose a looming threat to the mortgage industry. Lawyer David Durkee says for the banks that hold the mortgages, these homes with Chinese drywall are literally toxic assets.
We're going to have hundreds, if not thousands, of foreclosed homes that have this defective condition. The banks don't want that, the government doesn't want that, and these victims don't want that. So we need to make sure that this safety net is fixed and make sure that these victims don't fall through this safety net.
Some builders have stepped forward and begun replacing the defective drywall, but thousands of homeowners have turned to the courts. Many of the cases are before a federal judge in New Orleans, who plans to begin holding trials in January. Michael Ryan is an attorney who represents more than 250 homeowners with drywall claims. He says while the courts will eventually sort out who's liable, many homeowners won't be able to wait that long.
It's horribly complicated. There are multiple layers of insurance and responsibility, and it's so complex. That I really think that the trials are not going to be the answer for the homeowners or really for the building industry. What we really need is a federal response here to save these homeowners and to save, frankly, the building industry. Otherwise, we're going to see widespread bankruptcies on both sides.
The Consumer Product Safety Commission is due soon to release the results of its investigation of Chinese drywall, and that may clear the way for further federal action. In Louisiana, state officials are moving ahead with a plan to use $5 million in federal housing money to help homeowners replace their tainted drywall. Florida Senator Bill Nelson has sent a letter to state legislators asking them to see if a similar program could be adopted here. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now, the second story in our series, The End of Privacy. We're taking a closer look at whether privacy is still possible in the digital age. And we're joined once again by NPR's Martin Costi here at NPR West. Martin, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Martin, yesterday we were talking about a notion that you call privacy fatalism.
Yeah, I was talking about this notion that I've gotten from a lot of the people I interview for stories about privacy, about sort of a resignation, a sense that a lot of people have that things are spinning out of control, that they can't really control their privacy anymore in this high-tech era. But I should add that not everyone feels that way, and especially when you talk to younger people, you get a very different message. For instance, this is Seattle's nightclub district, where I recently went to talk to some 20-somethings about their privacy. We were outside some bars there, and I stopped a couple and asked them about their privacy, and they said they weren't worried about it. And all of them, every single one of them, gave the same reason.
Facebook. it's the social trend of today. Yeah, giving out information is social.
So who are these young people, Martin?
Well, that's Koa Metter and his friend Brian Liston. And I know that we've heard a lot about this so-called Facebook generation, how everybody under a certain age is an online exhibitionist and so on. The thing is, they're not really. Listen carefully to how Brian Liston talks about their online exposure.
You know, I bet you if you walk up and down the street, I bet you 75 to 85% of people will be a Facebook account. And if they're in the Seattle network, anybody else in the Seattle network, as long as their account's not private, can view their information.
Did you catch that? As long as their account's not private? There's an assumption there. The assumption is, if you set your privacy options right, you can limit your exposure to just your friends. That's part of the appeal of social networks. But the thing is, it's not always true.
Hello, this is Chris.
I made an internet phone call to Chris Conley at the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. He wanted to show me one way that a stranger might peek at your private social network, the Facebook quiz.
These quizzes are very common. If you go on Facebook, you see all of your friends have taken a quiz or several quizzes, depending on how much time they might spend online.
A quiz isn't just a quiz. It's a program written by some company or stranger you've never heard of. Programs can be programmed. In this case, they can be programmed to look at your account while you're busily answering questions.
Maybe it's what superhero is my dog? You think that all you're doing is answering a few seemingly innocent questions. You know, can he catch a frisbee? Does he wear a cape? But in fact, you're opening up your entire profile and almost all of your personal information to whoever wrote the quiz.
To demonstrate this, Conley wrote his own Facebook quiz. When you run the quiz, it scrapes your information, then it shows you what it got.
On my profile, it can see my name, my hometown, my birthday, my religious and political views.
Harvard Ballroom alumni. You're a ballroom dancer?
Yes.
Facebook is not pleased with Conley's quiz.
So I guess what I can say is it is technologically possible to write an application that abuses users' privacy, as does the ACLU's quiz.
Tim Sparapani is director of public policy at Facebook.
But when that happens, we find out about it, and we take action to enforce our terms of service. And then we take legal action to scrape back data that's been unlawfully or inappropriately gathered from our users.
Sparapani won't cite a specific case, but he says this kind of policing actually makes Facebook safer than the plain internet. Still, the company has promised, under pressure from Canada's privacy commissioner, to give users more control over what kind of information the quizzes get. But computer security expert Nathan Hamill says Facebook quizzes are almost beside the point. The real issue, he thinks, is the false assumption of privacy that people have on social networks.
When you're talking about using social networks, there's a perceived safety. So people are a lot more loose with their information because they don't realize the trust they're putting into this application developer.
So people open up more on social networks, and that kind of candor is worth money. Oren Hoffman is CEO of Rapleaf, a company whose computers are constantly searching what he calls the social web.
We look at lots of different pieces of data on the internet. Those include things like blogs and forums and discussion boards, social networks, review sites. All those things combined can give you a really good picture of a particular person.
Rapleaf's computers crawl only the public parts of social websites. Even so, it claims to have enough information to have insights on almost 400 million people worldwide. Those insights, as they call them, are sold to marketers, and Hoffman says that's a good thing. Information, whether it's credit scores or blog postings, makes the economy go.
If we didn't have data, our world wouldn't work. You'd have to put money down to get like a cable television or a cell phone or to get any of those things that we take for granted today.
But do we want those things affected by information from the social web? Those photos of you on Facebook, for example, smoking and drinking at parties. What effect will they have someday on, say, your health insurance premiums or your car loans? It's a question that gives even some 20-somethings pause, like Koa Metter outside that bar in Seattle.
If one day I can't get an anonymous drink anymore, I think that'll be sad.
For now, that anonymous drink is still possible. Just pay with cash and don't mention it online. Martin Costi, NPR News.
The musician Thomas Lauderdale built a successful career, yet he's still taking piano lessons. That classical music, heard here on an old recording, grew into a song of Lauderdale's own. The way it did tells you something about the creative process of Lauderdale's band, Pink Martini. Lauderdale and his colleagues assembled a song the way that you might make a collage. In fact, that classical composition became a pair of songs on their new album, Splendor in the Grass. The process begins with Lauderdale, his producer, and a chance encounter with some sheet music.
The Schubert was lying out on my piano, and somehow we were sort of like singing along with the melody, and just the phrase, and then you're gone, kind of popped in. And that's how it all sort of unfolded, just from that, from the Schubert and from the phrase, and then you're gone.
So they had a melody, they had a refrain, and they made this.
My dear Lorenzo, you take my hand and understand the tears that I have cried. We light the candles and pour the wine and laugh as if you'll never leave my side. You take me in your arms and tell me that I'll always be the only one. And then you're gone.
Pink Martini is a creation of Lauderdale and China Forbes, the singer we're hearing now. They became famous mixing different styles of music. Plenty of people do that, of course, but Pink Martini seems to do it with one eyebrow raised, so you're never quite sure if they're joking.
You come to see me on a Saturday presenting peonies, knowing just what to say.
What's happening in that song?
Well, it takes the theme from Fantasy for piano for four hands by Franz Schubert in F minor, and then suddenly it becomes a Latin beat sort of kicks in, and it becomes somewhere between I Will Survive, Shirley Bassey, and Schubert, and a tango.
What else can you throw in? Some cupcakes.
The idea was to sort of like, you know, it's sort of I'm not going to take it anymore kind of song. The opposite of that Shirley Bassey song, I Who Have Nothing. Mm. This is sort of like, I've got a lot and get lost.
Did you start with a different kind of song than you finished with?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I have, you know.
It was long and repetitive. We cut it down.
You know, the day that I tried to introduce this song to the band, they were not, nobody was happy.
It's a process, Steve.
And so we were sort of forlorn and ran away, and we started thinking about what if we did it to a swing beat? And suddenly we had not one but two songs. So it was like, you know, if you think this is repetitive, try this.
Well, let's play a little bit of the second song where we hear from the love interest who's walked out on you, China Forbes, but has come back briefly. And I should mention for our listeners, this is an NPR correspondent who will be very familiar to some of our listeners. And just listen a little bit and see if you can figure out who it is.
My dear Maria, I'm here to see you. Won't you please open the door? I brought you flowers, been waiting hours, can't stand it anymore. So here's what happened when you were napping. I just went out for a snack. I was feeling famished, and then I vanished. But now I'm back.
Pink Martini from their new recording, the second of a pairing of songs, the first from a woman singing about a man who's gone, the second a man announcing that he's back. And I told you that voice was an NPR correspondent. That correspondent is with us now. And, sir, would you please give us your NPR out cue?
Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
Justice correspondent and frequent guest host here on Morning Edition. How on earth did you end up on this recording?
I'm still trying to figure that one out.
It's you guys are old friends. Ago. We should say that. Yeah. You've known each other.
We both grew up in Portland, and so we've known each other for years. And in June, the band came to Washington, D.C. for a show. And I threw a dinner party for them and a bunch of D.C. friends and some other Portland folks. And the party turned into somehow a sing-along in the upstairs of my house around the piano. And the next day, sitting at my desk at NPR, Thomas calls me, and he says, "Will you do a song on the next album?" And I say this with love, Thomas tends to come up with sort of cockamamie, harebrained ideas that could never actually take place that somehow he manages to actually make happen.
Typical Pink Martini experience.
Is it? Really?
Kind of. Sometimes.
Sometimes it could be really by the seat of our pants, which is kind of, it makes it exciting.
That's how your pants get so many holes in them.
Keeps them on their toes.
Come on, this is morning radio.
Oh, sorry.
I'm not really a songwriter. China's more really of a songwriter than I am. My urge is more to just practice Schubert and try to become better.
I wonder, Mr. Lauderdale, if the word for you would be less a songwriter than a composer. And I mean that in a slightly different way than people would talk about a composer of music. You seem to compose instruments, compose people, pull different thoughts and ideas together that you get different places and rearrange them in new ways.
Or maybe like a ringmaster.
We're in a circus.
I guess so.
I don't
Well, the ringleader would be more like,
I liked composer. I think you're right. Composition in a painting, composition.
Right.
It's like a tableau, and Thomas is actually moving the figurines around. And
isn't that just
rearranging
called set decorator?
Interior designer.
Interior designer.
You're all of it. Pastry chef.
I can do all of it.
Now just be.
Thomas Lauderdale and China Forbes lead Pink Martini, whose new album is Splendor in the Grass. It features a guest appearance by NPR's Ari Shapiro and includes two songs inspired by a classical composition by Franz Schubert. And you can hear both those songs at nprmusic.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
In India, many homeowners feel haunted, not by defective building materials, but the old-fashioned way, by ghosts. Commentator Sandeep Roy knows that because he grew up in a haunted house in Calcutta.
Every day at dusk, I go around the house turning on the lights. My grandmother did it. My mother still does it. It's well known that twilight is the perfect time for wandering ghosts to sneak into the house. Haunted houses in India don't just have one ghost. It could be a whole family. There are shakchunnis and petnis, ghosts of women unlucky in love, who wear saris and pounce on eligible young men. Brahmadaitas are the ghosts of Brahmins and might bless you or curse you. The skandokatas are the headless ghosts of people who died in train accidents. They sound terrifying, but because they don't have heads, you can trick them easily. You do have to watch out for the very dangerous nishi, who call people by name in the dead of night and lead them away, never to be seen again. In one of my favorite movies when I was a kid, Gupi Gain Bhagabain, the king of ghosts, doled out wondrous gifts, food and music and shoes that could transport you anywhere. And of course, he sang. Once upon a time, ghosts used to hang out in old abandoned mansions and village ponds choked with moss. As India changed, Ghosts move to middle-class Calcutta neighborhoods like ours, to the trees in our backyards and driveways. Fig trees, banyan trees, the bale tree with its glossy green leaves and round golden fruits. Don't break its branches, my great-grandmother would say. You don't want to wake up the Brahmadaitya. On nights when the electricity went out and the oil lamps cast flickering shadows on the wall, we'd huddle together, swatting mosquitoes and listening to stories about graveyards and women in white saris. The hallways of the house, so nondescript by day, were suddenly eerie in the dark. I never saw the ghosts, but sometimes, in the dead of night, I would lie in bed and watch the neem tree through the window. During the day, we plucked its tender, bitter leaves and stir-fried them. But at night, the tree was a perch for ghosts. I'd start awake, convinced there was someone in the room. Paralyzed with fear, I'd wait for the first gray light of dawn to seep through the window. Now the ghosts are being stirred up again all over my old neighborhood. As families break up and children move away, the old houses are being torn down, replaced by boxy apartment buildings and glitzy malls. Ours was torn down as well. I remember asking my mother if we could at least save the neem tree. We couldn't. Apartments only have room for potted marigolds and money plants. But Petnis and Mamdabhuts can't haunt marigolds. In signing the death warrant of our house, we rendered the ghosts homeless. As I vigorously turn on the lights in the San Francisco dusk, I wonder what they're doing, the homeless ghosts of Calcutta. And I wonder what happens if a Nishi calls out your name and you're not there to answer.
Commentator Sandeep Roy talking with us as we approach Halloween. He's an editor with New America Media and host of New America Now on member station KALW in San Francisco. And you can comment on his essay by going to our opinion page at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Solving one problem can cause another. And we bring you an example of that truism today from the world of agricultural biotechnology. NPR's Joe Palca has this example of the law of unintended consequences.
When the biotech world was young, scientists and regulators struggled with a problem. They could put things called transgenes into seeds that would give crop plants desirable properties, such as resistance to disease. But ecologists worried what would happen if these transgenes spread from cultivated plants to their wild neighbors growing nearby.
People are concerned that when the transgene escapes into the wild populations, that it will provide a fitness advantage.
That's Andrew Stevenson. He's a plant ecologist at Penn State. A fitness advantage means the wild plants with this advantageous transgene might grow out of control, mucking up the ecosystem. Stevenson studies a wild squash plant called the Texas gourd.
The fruits are about the size of a baseball to the size of a softball, and they're round or slightly pear-shaped.
Tastes terrible. It shows up throughout the American Southwest and Mexico. Stevenson wanted to know what would happen when his wild gourd picked up a transgene that's used in cultivated squash to protect the crop from plant viruses. So he purposely created a strain of Texas gourd with the transgene and planted it next to the same gourd that didn't have the transgene. Then he waited for spring when aphids would bring a plant virus to the field.
As the virus spread through our field, it only affected the Texas gourd.
That is, the gourd without the transgene. As they report in the journal PNAS, at first, it looked like what scientists feared was happening. The plants that had the transgene did have that fitness advantage. They stayed healthy while their unmodified cousins got sick. But then something strange happened. After the aphids arrived in the field, along came another pest, the cucumber beetle. The beetles carry a different plant disease, not a virus, but a bacteria.
And these bacteria secrete an exopolysaccharide, like a snot-like stuff.
And when the beetles eat the gourd's leaves and flowers, this snot-like stuff gets into the plant's plumbing, first causing the leaves to wilt and ultimately killing the plant. But here's the funny thing. The cucumber beetle will eat plants that are sick with a virus.
But they tend not to like them, so they fly off to someplace else.
And that someplace else is the healthy plant, protected from the virus by the transgene. So,
as the virus spreads through the susceptible plants in the field, the beetles become increasingly concentrated onto the healthy transgenic plants.
Yes, the plants are protected from the virus, but that makes them more vulnerable to the bacteria. Stevenson says no one suspected that would happen.
And these indirect ecological effects were not predictable based on any sort of laboratory study.
Now, in this particular case, the unintended consequences aren't bad. The wild gourd apparently won't grow out of control. But Norman Elstrand says that's not the point. Elstrand is a plant geneticist at the University of California, Riverside.
We know the transgenes sometimes end up giving us unexpected effects. And when you do an experiment like Stevenson's group did, you see how complicated ecology actually is.
Because people basically say, oh, never thought of that.
Exactly.
In other words, you don't know what you don't know. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
The news that Bob Dylan was releasing an album of Christmas songs came as a surprise to many people. Now that Christmas in the Heart, all of whose profits go to charity, has been released, critics and Dylan fans are divided. Is the album an earnest effort or one big put-on? Rock critic Ken Tucker has his opinion.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away.
It's the worst album Dylan has released since 1970's Self-Portrait. It's a total ear bleeder. It's a hoax. These are just a few of the critical judgments that have already seen print about Christmas in the Heart. There's nothing like a mixture of sincerity, self-deprecating humor, and an appreciation for unfashionable aspects of the past to get people in full-bore sarcastic cynicism mode.
City sidewalks, busy sidewalks, dressed in holiday style. In the air there's a feeling of Christmas. Children laughing, people passing, meeting smile after smile. And on every street corner you'll hear silver bells, silver bells. It's Christmas time in the city.
In the criticisms of Christmas in the Heart, there's the odd complaint that Dylan's voice sounds awful. I'm sorry, have you not been listening to Dylan for the past decade or for most of his entire career? An imperfect vocal instrument is at once characteristic and a limitation that Dylan has frequently turned to his advantage. As far as the idea that covering songs such as Christmas Island and Here Comes Santa Claus is cornball, well, the flip side of cornball is amusement in context. Dylan, producing himself under the name Jack Frost, is surrounded by sweet choral voices and arrangements straight out of a 1960s middle-of-the-road or country-politan album. It's just that instead of hearing Johnny Mathis or Eddie Arnold crooning, you have Dylan croaking with both solemnity and a wink.
Aloha, ay, aloha, ay, aloha, oh, hi. How'd you like to spend Christmas? How'd you like to spend the holiday away across the sea?
Come on, that's fun in the manner of other Christmas songs, ranging from Eartha Kitt's Santa Baby to The Waitress's Christmas Wrapping. So is this polka rhythm version of Must Be Santa, with help from Los Lobos' David Hidalgo on accordion.
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Santa's got a beard that's long and white.
Who comes round on special night?
Santa comes round on special night.
Special night, beard that's white.
Must be Santa, must be Santa, must be Santa, Santa Claus.
Yes, indeed, there are some lousy clunkers on this album. I don't think anyone is capable of making Little Drummer Boy endurable. And yes, I do remember the campy, sincere Bing Crosby-David Bowie collaboration from years ago. And Dylan does make his slow, deliberate version of I'll Be Home for Christmas sound more like a threat than a promise.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree.
As is consistent with current Dylan, the album operates as a further exploration of American popular song in all its forms, no matter how uncool. In the same spirit as his satellite radio show, Dylan presides over Christmas in the Heart with some put-ons, some sincerity, some goofy humor, and some deep dives into the mystery of what it means to celebrate the birth of Christ in both Latin and kitsch. Proceeds from this album will go to a charity, Feeding America. What can I say? This holiday season, while trimming the tree, I am just as likely to put on Christmas in the Heart as frequently as I do Phil Spector's great album, A Christmas Gift for You. Ho, ho, ho.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly.